couple of days, and it's always nice to come back to Waterloo. So by the end of this talk, I'm going to explain what this little picture is that's hiding back here, and in particular, what's going on at the center of it. And so we feel that we have some strong evidence that in some potential experiments that might be happening in the not-too-distant future that kind of inspired us to think about these things in the first place, that there might be a Luttinger liquid state, and I'll explain what that is, hiding in the center of some helium-4-filled nanopores. So this was work started with my postdoc supervisor, Ian Affleck, and we collaborated with Massimo Bonansani at University of Alberta. Actually, some of the original simulations took place on Canadian computational infrastructure, and the current ones all go on at the VACC. This is the Vermont Advanced Computing Center, which is, you know, you hear about these earmark projects that US senators always do. This is one of those, where some senator snuck this in on some bill, and we got some nice computing infrastructure at the University of Vermont. So we're pretty happy to have this. Okay, so if I want to start talking about, oh, it's hard to see here, if I want to start talking about unconventional or more exotic phases, we need to start with the most trivial type of phase diagram that I can think of. So if I have some pressure, and again, it's probably difficult to see temperature down here, this is some very vanilla phase diagram where I have a triple point that where a solid, liquid, and gas can coexist. This is something that you'd see in, you know, many pure elemental materials and other simple liquids. That so basically the point here is that these three phases, solid, liquid, and gas, all coexist. So this is the conventional thing that we can try to test unconventional things against in some sense. And so one of the most unconventional things is helium-4. So helium-4 is a bosonic system. So the phase diagram in helium-4 looks like this. This one's a little easier to see. So again, the same axes, temperature and pressure. So we have the gas and the liquid coexisting over here, but we never find this triple point where the solid, liquid, and gas can all coexist at the same point. Instead, we have a phase transition to some more exotic state known as a superfluid. So this is some macroscopically quantum state of matter with phase coherence. It has all kinds of interesting properties, flow without viscosity through very narrow channels that are called superleaks. So this is sort of the paradigm of quantum matter in an elemental, you know, simple elemental picture. And so this is all old stuff. But a natural question to ask is, what makes helium so special compared to, why is the phase diagram look different than other ones? And so the answer to that, there's many ways to understand this. You know, I came at this work on helium from more of a field theory side of things, and so learning about elemental helium was all new to me and trying to understand the physics going on here. So I was impressed by this stuff anyways when I learned it. So if we think about helium-4, as I said, it's light, right? It's bosonic. Helium-4, the bosonic flavor is very abundant. 99.9 something percent of helium is helium-4, and it's reasonably weakly interacting. So this is some plot of some Leonard Jones-like potential interaction between two helium atoms, and I've shown one for two neon atoms as well on here. So this is this potential versus distance. So the first thing that you notice compared to neon is that the interactions are weaker, right? This attractive minimum is much weaker. So that's one thing to note. The next thing is, if we just consider the thermal de Broglie wavelength, right, inversely proportional to mass and temperature, square rooted. Well, if we plot a bar that represents that thermal de Broglie wavelength, which is some length scale, well, it turns out that in helium, it almost exactly corresponds to this minimum in the potential. So if I just throw a bunch of heliums together and start cooling them down, well, at some point, so this is never going to happen at any reasonable temperature in neon, this is the similar de Broglie wavelength in neon, in helium we're going to get this thermal de Broglie wavelength somehow measuring how quantum or the wavelength of these helium atoms is going to correspond to the natural separation where they want to coexist. Right? So this de Broglie wavelength is approximately equal to average separation between atoms, and so you can understand why it's so quantum then. They can tell that they all start acting like waves, and there's some kind of BC type phenomenon going on. So this is, it's the only bosonic system that's just an elemental system where this occurs, and this leads to all kinds of cool experimental properties. So this is a case where you have some beaker of helium, and you cool it below the lambda transition where it becomes a superfluid, and it can take advantage of the wetting layer. It can lower its energy by basically flowing up the surface of this beaker, and eventually this beaker will actually empty. And this is because it can flow without dissipation, and so it actually can take advantage, again, of this wetting layer, and then eventually this beaker will just empty. So there's all kinds of cool things related to this macroscopic quantum state. So the question that I want to pose then is, as I said, one of the ways historically that A superfluid was even called a superfluid was because the superfluid liquid helium could, the superfluid helium could flow through very narrow channels that the regular liquid couldn't penetrate. So for example, you could take a very narrow channel and pack a bunch of powder in it and then force helium to go through it, and the liquid helium above the lambda transition wouldn't flow through, but below the superfluid transition it would. So what happens inside such a superleak? So that's what such a channel would be called, that only helium could flow through, superfluid helium could flow through. What happens when the radius of that superleak becomes smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where we cross over to some one-dimensional limit, as R goes to zero, if you like? So we know all kinds of interesting things about one-dimensional systems, and I hope to convince you why that they're particularly interesting, but this was the question that really motivated us, both from the theoretical dimensional crossover side of things, but also from some experiments that I'm gonna talk about. Okay, so as a kind of rough outline, as I said, I'm hopefully gonna try to convince you why I personally believe 1D systems are special and interesting. I'll talk about these some real experiments going on, the method that we use, which is this worm algorithm, path integral, quantum Monte Carlo, and finally the evidence that we think we found for a Luttinger liquid inside these, inside some narrow pores filled with helium. All right, so we'll start with this. So this is some pretty basic stuff. This is my simple view of why I think 1D systems are interesting. So the first thing is enhancement of fluctuations. So for suitably short-range interactions, we can't even have a stabilized long-range order solid in 1D, even at zero temperature. So quantum fluctuations are large, and the positional uncertainty in the position of, in this case, it's just some harmonic solid, imagine balls and springs, is larger than the average separation between them. And the easiest way to think about this is there's some Debye-Waller type factor which is related to the intensity of some Bragg peaks and some structure factor. So I can look at if I did an X-ray scattering experiment on such a 1D system, what I would find. And so this Debye-Waller factor W that shows up here is related to the excitations, the low energy excitations in such a one-dimensional solid, which are phonons. Right? So this is, would be the integral that we would do to compute this Debye-Waller factor. And in strictly 1D, we have some linear dispersion here for these low energy density modes. And because in 1D, we get basically dk over k, and we have some logarithmic singularity, some infrared singularity, this Debye-Waller factor goes to infinity. And so the intensity of order that we would see in an X-ray experiment would be zero. And this is just some special case of Merman-Wagner-Hohenberg, specific to 1D. Right? We can't break translational symmetry in this one-dimensional system. So there's going to be lots of fluctuations. And so maybe, you know, it's always interesting to try to understand strongly fluctuating systems when we can say something about them, because there's many strongly fluctuating systems that we can say almost nothing about. So maybe there's some paradigms that can be better understood. Another one is particle statistics. So, you know, normally we define particle statistics by the sign of the wave function under some kind of permutation. But we're in truly a one-dimensional system, we don't have the phase space to even perform this experiment, right? If I have, let's say, hardcore particles, I can't move them around each other. I can't do that physical exchange. So somehow particle statistics become less important in 1D, and bosons and fermions behave the same way. And actually, you can't even tell the difference in a strictly 1D system at low densities between hardcore bosons and free fermions. Look at the excitation spectrum, you can't tell the difference between them. So that's reasonably interesting. Another thing is the types of excitations that are allowed. So if you want to think about density excitations, so in a high dimensional system, I come in, I give one of these bosons or one of these particles a kick. Well, maybe the other atoms arrange themselves slightly, but there's some path at low enough densities where I can still consider things in terms of just a single particle excitation, right? But in 1D, because we're in strictly 1D, again, this phase space argument, all excitations are effectively collective. If I bump into one, it's going to hit another one, and this is going to propagate. So the excitations are, by their very nature, collective. My favorite thing about 1D systems is that you can calculate all kinds of cool stuff. There's both effective and exact solutions for many 1D systems, strongly interacting systems. This is something that's again, reasonably rare. So exactly at zero temperature, in the thermodynamic limit, we have beta ansatz type solutions. So if I have something like a Lieb-Leninger gas, which is bosons interacting with delta function interactions, there's an exact solution. You can calculate anything that you want. We know the partition function. At finite temperature, there's so-called thermodynamic beta ansatz, again, in the thermodynamic limit. And another thing is that we can actually build effective low-energy descriptions based on some linear hydrodynamic theory where we can actually include interactions non-perturbatively. Right? So we have some interacting theory. If I'm in strictly one dimensions, I can build up some effective low energy long wavelength theory where I actually deal with the interactions, not in a perturbative manner, but in a real consistent manner. And so this is the sort of Luttinger liquid idea. And Haldane in this seminal paper in 1981 kind of unified the bosonic and fermionic side of things into some general theory of one-dimensional quantum liquids. And it's this language of Haldane that I'm going to use in this talk. So this is my one slide introduction to everything you need to know about Luttinger liquid theory, at least for bosons. So basically, let's start with a 1D interacting Bose gas. This is some second quantized form. So I have some Hamiltonian, which has some kinetic piece right here. This field psi is just represents the boson density at a site, or you can think of it as a creation operator, whatever you like. And then I have some interaction here. And it turns out actually that the form of this interaction isn't particularly important, as long as it's not pathological in some way. For any reasonably behaved systems, everything's going to go through. So the density of particles at a site X is just related to this bilinear of these boson operators. And I can do the thing that we normally do, where I'm going to write the individual field operator in terms of some square root of density. So this is real mass density, which I'm going to write as the gradient of some phase. So I've introduced some new field. And then I have the exponential of some phase. So this is some usual density phase representation for my boson field. But 1D is special in many ways. And it turns out that there's some unique way that's starting. So if I substitute this into this Hamiltonian that has this quartic interactions, and I perform some manipulations, the things that pops out at the end is the following expression. So we went from a Hamiltonian in terms of these second quantized boson field psi to some new Hamiltonian in terms of some new phase degrees of freedom, phi and theta. And you'll notice that this thing is only quadratic in these degrees of freedom. So I've just done some mapping, if you like, that changes my degrees of freedom. But in these new collective degrees of freedom, this theta is going to be related to density fluctuations, and this is phase fluctuations. The resulting Hamiltonian is quadratic. Moreover, there's additional terms that would come in here, but these are all formally irrelevant in some kind of RG sense. So they have powers of 1 over system size in front of them, if you like. And so in the thermodynamic limit, or even for large systems, you know, this is not perturbation theory in an interaction. This is perturbation theory in the system size. I mean, these terms are effectively zero. And so where do these parameters come from? Well, now we have some velocity v and some so-called Luttinger parameter k. So these parameters, which are effective properties of this low-energy effective field theory, this Luttinger liquid Hamiltonian here, are related to the microscopic details of this Hamiltonian. So this is some high-energy Hamiltonian that would describe something like helium inside a nanopore. Right? And so there's properties of this, like the mass of the helium atoms and the details of this interaction, like the compressibility. Those things go into producing these parameters, and we'll see a little bit more about that later on. And they're related in some physical way. So V over K is related to the superfluid density, and this product VK is related to the compressibility. All right, so we can think about the phase that such a 1D quantum fluid would have. So I've done this for a bosonic system, but it turns out that for a fermionic system, nothing changes effectively in this description. So we're in strictly, yep. Right, so these are canonically conjugate, basically. So there's some, the commutation between this vertex operator and this thing right here gives me a delta function.
So theta and phi commutation is a delta function.
Yeah. The conjugate momentum, which is related to this, is the usual delta function, right? So there's some e to the I phi, this vertex operator, that's what gets the delta function. Okay, so my kind of hand-waving description of we're in 1D, right? So I said we can never have long-range order. Fluctuations are very large, right? Turns out that the phase that this Hamiltonian describes is some continuous phase that always has quasi-long-range order. Correlation functions are always algebraic. And this parameter k, the so-called Luttinger parameter, can tune us all the way from a superfluid at k equals 0 to a solid at k equals infinity. And it's easy to see this from this Hamiltonian. So let's say we're down here at k equals 0. So if we're at k equals 0, we can forget about this term. So this is the only term that matters. I want to minimize this to make it as small as possible. I can do that. Here I have a gradient of phi or a derivative of phi. So if I want this term to be small, I need phi to be constant. So I need to have a phase a single phase that's constant in space that describes my system everywhere. So that's just, I have some long range phase coherence. It's just a superfluid. That's down here. On the flip side, if I have a really large K, I can forget about this term. Then this becomes the dominant term. I want this to be as small as possible. And if I look back up here, that means that I have some constant density, basically. And so a constant density corresponds to a solid in this picture. So this is, as I tune K, I move back and forth between these two. And the interesting thing is, for a given real one-dimensional system or quasi-one-dimensional system, like helium atoms in some nanopore, where do we fall on this line? And that's really the question that we're trying to ask. Can we simulate some high-energy microscopic system using quantum Monte Carlo and watch how this low-energy effective description emerges, and then do some matching and fitting and try to understand the physics of the emergent system to figure out where we are between this superfluid and this solid? Yep.
Here.
Right. So in this case, there's no lattice, right? I have a fully Galilean invariant system. I have continuum bosons. So the only length scale, so there could be a length scale related to the interaction, right? Let's say my interaction was hardcore bosons, then there'd certainly be a length scale there. And then there's kind of some emergent length scale that's just related to the density. So I have some chemical potential, which sets an average density, which then, you know, the inverse of that density gives me an average separation between bosons. And so that's all hidden in, you know, V is a velocity, so there's a length that can be constructed of these various things. Is that okay? So this is the kind of theoretical background. Now on to what's actually going on in some experiments. So Guillaume Gervais at McGill had this idea that if he took a slab of silicon nitride and exposed it to a TEM beam, and provided that it was vibration isolated enough that this transmission electron beam was very, very stable, turns out that this beam will actually bore an extremely nice, almost perfect cylindrical net pore through this silicon nitride. And so this is a real picture of it. So you can see it's pretty close to cylindrical. And this is actually a reasonably wide one. Now he's got this down where you can get pores of on the order of a couple nanometers in radius. So this is extremely small. And then there's some width to this thing, 50 nanometers or so, and then you can put it in such a system where the pore is kind of the constriction. I have helium that flows in, helium that flows out, and I have a mass spectrometer on this side. So I can actually measure flow through this nanopore. So in the longest ones that he's done are something like 50 to 1, and the shortest ones are basically, he calls them pores, I'd call them holes. They're like 1 to 1 or 2 to 1 or something like that. And so this is really the mock-up here. So I have helium at some pressure. He does atmospheric. Here's my nanohole, and here's basically a mass spectrometer that can calculate individual helium atoms, and I have vacuum outside here. And so he was basically able, so the first order zero experiment was, well, let's see if we can understand this for the gas phase, right? The totally classical system. And so he did that, and everything can be explained very nicely. So basically, this is a reasonably complicated plot. So pressure here is increasing to the left, so that's cranking up the pressure on this side. And this is at fixed temperature in the gas phase for helium. And you can look at this conductance. And so the data points here are in red, and what he's showing in these other lines is that at high pressure, we basically just get Navier-Stokes type flow. This is all classical. So that fits reasonably well. Then at low temperatures, at low pressures, this is all at fixed temperature, you basically get statistical flow. So you have extremely low pressures. You have, think of it as having a box with a hole in it, and so you can describe the helium leaving, the helium gas leaving through that hole in some statistical way, and that's this red line right here. And in terms of the science of fluid dynamics, you can understand all of this in terms of the so-called Knudsen number, which is the ratio of mean free path to pore diameter. This all works extremely well. It works actually so well that you could do this experiment, measure the mean free path by other terms, and back out the pore diameter. So it works incredibly well. So then the natural next step would be, well, let's cool this thing down below the lambda transition in bulk helium and see what happens. And so that's what they did. Yep. That's an excellent question, and it comes from both of those things. And you'll see more about that in a couple of minutes. Great question. So the natural thing to do would be, well, let's just cool this down to 2 Kelvin. This is where the lambda transition is. And so that's what they tried to do at first. And by its very nature, superfluid helium is difficult to deal with. And they found out that the glue they were using in this was penetrable to superfluid helium. And so they did this experiment at low temperatures, and helium just squirted out everywhere. So then they changed the glue and changed the apparatus, and then they blocked it off completely, and then the whole thing kind of blew up at high pressures. And so many iterations were trying to get this thing going. So it turns out that there's a later iteration of this through where they're able to see superfluid flow through essentially what I call holes. And there they can understand something about the mass flow and superfluid density through those holes. But I'm not going to talk about that because I'm interested in the quasi 1D case, the long aspect ratio case. But there's further iterations happening basically, and they're getting there. So they're getting a curve of basically, yeah, rho s versus temperature at different pressures. It's different from the bulk, and not only that, they see large normal fractions even in holes that are pretty narrow, in the order of a couple. And they see it shift down to lower temperatures.
TC is different?
Yeah, yeah. This is in PRL this year. Actually, I have a plot here I can show you. Yeah, so this is the plot from the paper. Sorry, I skipped it. I left this out for sake of brevity. So this is temperature versus mass flow, basically, and they see some uptick where they see superfluid flow.
Question?
Yeah.
Historically, this was a geometry where they saw Josephson flow.
Yeah.
So does it interfere here, or is there any way to...
Well, so here, this is an incredibly out-of-equilibrium experiment where they basically have vacuum on one side, and...
I see.
But in principle, you're right, and what I'm thinking about is more along those lines, the Josephson type experiment. Okay, so this is my theorist schematic view of what's going on inside a cross-section of this pore. So here is my silicon nitride. People know a lot about this material. It's used in all kinds of experimental situations. The surfaces are understood. What happens when you cleave it, when you cut it, it's amorphous. So much is known about the surface. And this green line right here is the interaction potential that you would get between a helium atom and the surface of this silicon nitride pore. And basically, it looks like this. The radius of this particular pore here is 12 angstroms. There's some excluded volume because of hard core type effects. And then you get some deep minimum. And this is just wetting, the same thing that you would get if you pour a cup of water onto a desk. There's some wetting that happens. There's some attractive potential here. So there's some length scale associated with this radius. Then this blue curve is the one I already showed you. This is the so-called disease potential, but it basically looks like a Leonard Jones type interaction between helium. So there's these two types of interactions. Helium are interacting with each other, and they're interacting with the walls. Yeah. So this is like a cutaway of the pore. I'm looking down on it. So this is the vacuum basically inside the pore, and then I start adding some helium into it. Right. Okay. So
this potential, is it measured with respect to the wall or with respect to one atom on the wall? Like, is it integrated around?
It's integrated around, yeah. So basically what you do is you start with some Leonard Jones. You know all kinds of information about the properties of this thing, and you just do the cylindrical integrals in it. You can write it in terms of special functions. It's actually a really fun math problem to try to do this. So it's easy. You know, if you have an infinite half plane, you can very trivially figure out the integrated Leonard Jones for that, which gives you something that looks like this. If you wrap it up into a cylinder, you can do the integrals. They just become, they're written in terms of special functions. But it's kind of a fun little calculation
so
to do.
So the powers change? R6 becomes some other power?
Yeah, so it's the usual, I guess, 3.9 is what it changes to. Yeah, effectively, asymptotic limit. So when Guillaume and I were originally talking about these things a couple of years ago, I said, well, what's a pore that you think that you could make? What are the sizes of it? So he said, well, we can make one that's 40 nanometers long. So I put 400 angstroms in here for the length and 24 angstroms in diameter, so you know, 2.4 nanometers. So I computed the volume of such a pore and helium at saturated vapor pressure. This is the 3D density. And so I just checked back of the envelope how many helium atoms are going to be inside such a nanopore. So you can do this, and it's 2,000. And so when I did this calculation and saw this number, I kind of did a fist pump because this 2,000 is kind of the maximum number of bosons, of helium atoms, that you can exactly simulate with quantum Monte Carlo. So we can do a real, almost fully ab initio numerical experiment of what's going on in here. We can fully simulate 2,000 quantum helium atoms, all their interactions with the wall, and try to really understand microscopically what's going on in this system and search for this emergent behavior that's given me this long wavelength Luttinger liquid type physics. So I was pretty excited when I saw this number. Okay, so how do we study such a system? And so the technique we're going to use is this worm algorithm, path integral quantum Monte Carlo. And of course, you should all tell me to just stop right now, because the experiment, as I said, is the most out of equilibrium thing you could possibly imagine. It's finite density or finite pressure helium on one side, vacuum on the other side. And I'm telling you, I'm going to study this with some equilibrium method. So in my mind, I'm imagining two helium baths, the Moore Josephson type experiment, two helium baths at very close pressures, and then this pore in between them. And that's really the system that I'm going to study. And I'm going to hope to understand structure and behavior in that. And then maybe one day the experiment can catch up, or there's some common ground. At least we can learn interesting things about this system. Okay, so some people will be very familiar with the next couple of slides. This is my kind of couple slide introduction to the method, path integral quantum Monte Carlo, originated by David Sepperly and lots of people work with this method. So the idea is that we have some Hamiltonian, some interacting Hamiltonian, some kinetic energy. There could be some external potential and some interaction, pairwise interaction between helium atoms, let's say. So again, we know all these things very well. We know what this external potential is in our case. It comes from the wall, interaction between helium atoms. So this is a cartoon of, again, a slice of this pore, and all these helium atoms are interacting. And so we can write this in terms of some position basis, which is the position of all the first quantized, position of all the helium atoms inside the pore. And so what we want to do is compute this quantum partition function in this position basis. So we're going to write the density matrix in the position basis, and we just need to do this trace. Beta here is the inverse temperature. So this is what I want to calculate on a computer, basically. All right, so I always like to say that this line here is the reason that I have a job. Basically, quantum statistical mechanics is hard because the kinetic and potential pieces of some Hamiltonian written this way don't commute. So we can't just write things like this. If we could, we could all just do classical Monte Carlo and go home. Not only does this not work, if you just naively wrote this, then of course corrections are of order inverse temperature. So at low temperatures in the quantum system, we make huge errors that are basically divergent. So it'd be nice if we could do this, because the kinetic piece then just decouples as a product of a bunch of Gaussian integrals, which we can do exactly, and we could just do classical Monte Carlo on this potential piece. But this is why it's tough. But one can make the trivial observation that, well, the Hamiltonian commutes with itself, obviously. So I can break up these two pieces of the Hamiltonian, this inverse temperature here, and write the following like this. But the point is, because beta is inverse temperature, these effective density matrices are actually at higher temperature. So I've just done this once. I've decoupled this density matrix into the product of two higher temperature density matrices, right? So if I can do this twice, I can certainly do it m times. I can insert a bunch of resolutions of the identity, and I can write my partition function as the product of a bunch of these matrix elements. So this is just some really, really high dimensional integral. And such high dimensional integrals are expertly done via Metropolis sampling and Monte Carlo type methods. So this is what we're going to do. So just to be grounded in the physical language that people that do path integral Monte Carlo talk about, we're always talking about bosonic world lines or paths. So let's say I have a 1D system that has two particles in it, and I'll do six such divisions. So I do six slices. Then this is what the effective partition function would look like. Right? I have six such terms, and a state is just going to be the x position of both of these particles. But now I need to have one such state for each of these slices, these times I've broken up the Hamiltonian. And so these trajectories, these bosonic world lines, this is just the usual Feynman path integral decomposition of the Hamiltonian, correspond to these imaginary time trajectories of my particles. And you can interpret this in terms of the single particle time evolution operator in quantum mechanics, where each of these steps corresponds to some time evolution, but now it's an imaginary time instead of real time. And this is the usual quantum statistical mechanics type approach. But because I have a trace, the initial and final states have to be the same up to particle permutations. Here I've made these two indistinguishable, so the initial and final positions here have to be the same. So this is the picture that one should have in their mind. We're doing Monte Carlo on these paths. And there's this nice mapping corresponding to David Chandler between these things, these bosonic quantum world lines, and classical ring polymers. So because the head and the tail, or these things are wrapped on this beta cylinder, I can actually just connect them. and they look like this, right? They look like classical ring polymers. So I can imagine moving these classical ring polymers around, and they correspond to these trajectories. All right, so I drew those two world lines corresponding to two bosons, two helium atoms in my pore as blue and orange, but of course these are indistinguishable particles. And so really what I have is these trajectories, but in fact, I only know the corresponding positions at certain slices that we call imaginary time slices. And so if I take away those lines that were guiding your eye, then there's no way for me to tell whether or not these are two independent paths, or this is some longer path, two linked paths, two particles get close together, their trajectories can get crossed, can get mixed up. And in this classical ring polymer picture, the two individual ring polymers have now merged into one. And so now both of these particles belong to the same trajectory. And you can actually imagine, or you can see that you could actually possibly reduce your kinetic energy by doing this. So you don't have to make as many hard turns as you go around and make sure that you have, you know, imaginary time periodicity. So you can lower your kinetic energy by doing this, link up these polymers. And one way to think about how this happens is as we do this, as a macroscopic fraction of the particles that we're studying link up into the same long trajectories, then this is basically Bose-Einstein condensation. So it's a macroscopic occupation of some single state. And so this is the, yep.
Turn doesn't matter.
Well, okay, yeah, so that's a good point. I mean, then basically you can reduce the effective spring length in such a picture. Okay, so this is my partition function. Now, the point of doing all this, of course, was that each of these individual density matrices, which now has a tau here, which is beta inverse temperature divided by some large integer, is at some effective high temperature. Right? And so I can make some high temperature effective approximation for each of these density matrices written in the position basis. And in the limit where m goes to infinity, this becomes exact. And the result is some partition function that looks like this. And again, this is just some really high dimensional integral that has two pieces. It has some kinetic term, which is what you were just mentioning, and some effective potential term. So this potential term right here where individual time slices corresponding to different particles, different trajectories interact with each other. This, all the kind of details are on here. So there's many ways that you can deal with this term. You know, the more effort you put in, the more accurate your simulation can get. And so the procedure that we use is accurate up to tau to the fourth. And if you're willing to do a lot of work, you can get even better. And there's all kinds of approximations that you can do. So you can think of this as just, this looks like Gaussian integrals. You can actually exactly sample these trajectories, and then you have to just use Monte Carlo Metropolis sampling on this effective potential piece of the action. So you can just do, Metropolis type sampling on this effective d plus one dimensional classical system, which corresponds to these ring polymers. Okay, so this is not the full picture, because what's really hard to do is deal with this indistinguishability of particles, and so circa, 10 years ago, the maximum number of indistinguishable bosons you could study with this method were on the order of 100 at suitably high accuracy. And the problem is that you have this permutation symmetry, and it's suppressed prohibitively by basically a factor of n factorial, the worst scaling you could imagine. You have n factorial possible particle permutations if you have indistinguishable particles. So reasonably recently, In continuous space, the so-called worm algorithm has been developed, and it's essentially a way to get around this sampling, this sampling of indistinguishable particles problem. And one does this by moving into the grand canonical ensemble. So now we allow the total number of particles to fluctuate, and we work in some extended configuration space, which is the grand canonical partition function, plus some set of off-diagonal configurations that correspond to things called worms, which I'll explain in a second. These worms contribute to the single particle green function, and they allow you in some local way to generate all such n factorial permutations in a very uncostly way. So the z prime is basically, so here was the picture I had before where these things wrapped around. There was this ring polymer picture. Now I allow kind of non-physical fluctuations, if you like, which correspond to worms that both start and end at some point. So you can imagine that a particle pops into existence at some imaginary time, it propagates, and then it disappears. This is just some single particle green function. The the partition function is just the sum or the trace over all positions of the head and the tail, and this thing shifted around. So there's two things that this lets us do. One is this allows us to move into the grand canonical ensemble. So now I can actually create and destroy particles. So I can insert one of these worms, and then the worm can grow, so it can propagate further, and eventually the head and the tail of this worm can find each other and connect. And then, bam, I have an extra particle in my simulation. Or I can do the opposite. I could imagine that one of these trajectories opens up, and then it can shrink to a point and disappear. That would reduce the number of particles by one. So this lets me explore the full grand canonical ensemble, which is much closer to the particular experimental situation. And the other thing that this allows you to do is the head and the tail of this worm, you can think of them as being reasonably free. So you can think of these connections here as being little springs. And so this particular bead right here has two springs connected to it. So it's reasonably constrained. But the head and the tail of this worm, you can think of them as being a little more floppy. They're less constrained by this kinetic pieces of this thing. And so these head and tail can kind of wander around. And when they get too close to one of these closed particle trajectories, they can exchange. So this is the so-called swap. And this leads the ability, so that here the head could lock onto this one. So this would jump down here. The tail could jump onto this one. So very slowly, very quickly, you can build up long multi-particle exchange cycles using only local moves. The head gets close to this one, it jumps on. Then the tail gets close to this one, it jumps on. And so you can build longer and longer and longer worms. So it's longer and longer and longer trajectories, and these correspond to these indistinguishable particle exchanges. Okay, so just a quick picture of putting this all together. So this is a simulation. I'm going to show you a video in Monte Carlo time of strictly one-dimensional helium. So I'm not at the nanopore yet. This is just for schematic purposes. At low temperatures, fixed chemical potential, some system size, and some imaginary time step. And these two pictures, this is the world line picture, imaginary time space at periodic boundary conditions in both of these directions. So I can map these onto a torus. All right, so basically whenever you see an orange or pink thing here, this is a worm that's in the simulation. And if we wait a couple of seconds, we can see this whole thing go superfluid. So these worms start getting longer and longer. You can see them showing up. They start connecting more of these things up to each other. And eventually, all of these will have been connected into a single long exchange cycle. And then the whole system can actually, all of these trajectories can move as one. So now you see they're getting longer and longer. And then bam, all of them are part of the same trajectory. And this is would have some finite superfluid response. Yep. Am I enhancing it artificially?
Yeah.
So in the partition function, all possible permutations are possible. Some may be energetically favored over others. So I'm sampling them in a stochastic way. So you know they are there or they're not there based on the temperature. At high temperatures, only the identity permutation is likely. At low temperatures, I can have multi-particle permutations. All right, so the one really nice thing about working in the position basis is that we have access to any types of observables that can be written in the position basis. And so we can learn all kinds of things. And the two things I'm going to focus on in the remaining 15 minutes of this talk are one that's going to tell me about the structure inside nanopores. So I'm going to do the simulation of these nanopores that eventually Guillaume may be able to study in the lab at low temperatures. So we can study structure by looking at the radial density. So this is what's the probability of having a boson at some radius inside the pore. And if I want to try to understand the phase, to understand the emergent properties corresponding to this effective Luttinger liquid description, I can study something like the pair correlation function. If I did a Fourier transform of this, I'd get a structure factor. So this is, if I have density at some distance along the pore, what's the probability of there being a particle at some further distance? So now I hope to convince you what we've actually found in these simulations. So there's a rather long review-like paper that I put on the archive recently on this stuff. And then last year, some preliminary stuff was published in PRL. Okay, so the details of the specific system are we're in a fully three-dimensional system. So that little movie I just showed you is for one-dimensional helium. Now I'm in 3D. I'm in this nanopore geometry where I have a Z's interaction between the individual helium atoms. And then I have this helium pore interaction. The number of atoms is going to change as I change the radius. Can be thousands. Fix the chemical potential at saturated vapor pressure. So a priori, I don't know how many particles are going to fill up this pore. I have a host of lengths between 5 and 20 nanometers. And we found actually once you get up to about 10, then the aspect ratio doesn't make that much of a difference. You see, once the aspect ratio is about 1:8 or 8:1, a lot of the stuff just comes through. We study a bunch of radiuses, a bunch of temperatures, and we used about 20 CPU years of computational time to do this. Okay, so as a first step, let's forget about the kinetic energy. Let's just think about classical helium filling up a pore with this type of wetting potential. So imagine I have a helium reservoir, completely classical helium atoms, and I have this pore. So the wall of this pore has this wetting potential. This is the pore potential. And these things have been studied at various degrees of sophistication and detail. So the picture is kind of easy to understand, I think. So I have vacuum inside here, and all of a sudden I open up this reservoir. And so I have this minimum of the potential. So basically helium is just going to keep flowing into this pore until it's fully saturated the minimum of this potential. And because of the cylindrical symmetry, this is going to correspond to just a cylindrical shell, right? So this is the same thing as if you pour water onto a hard surface, it forms a film on top. Imagine if I had cylindrical symmetry, I didn't have gravity, right? I could just roll this thing up and I would get such a cylindrical layer of helium. So this is a shell of helium. Now I've kind of saturated this. I can't fit any more helium atoms into this shell because now I need to worry about the fact that there's a hard core really between two helium atoms, right? This helium Aziz, Leonard Jones like potential at short distances, there's a lot of repulsion. So I can only fill up this shell so much. And once I fill it up to a certain amount, then bam, I'm going to jump to an inner shell and I could get a set of such shells based on the radius. And the distance between these shells is going to be related to the hard core interaction length, if you like, between helium atoms. And so based on the particular chemical potential and the radius of the pore, it's possible to get a set of nested concentric cylindrical shells of helium. And if I tune the radius just right, or if I tune the chemical potential just right, right in the very center, I could get a strictly 1D chain of helium that's completely stabilized by this cylindrically symmetric interaction. So this is the potential only picture. Now, once I turn on this kinetic energy, when I treat these things as indistinguishable quantum particles, what's going to happen is there's going to become exchanges between these layers, right? I'm going to be able to move between them, and that's what we're going to be able to study. Okay, so now some pictures to back up this kind of toy thing that I'm talking about. So these graphs are the radial density. So this is the density averaged over the axial length of the pore and angle as a function of position. The center of the pore is here, and I'm going to study nanopores all the way up to 12 angstroms in radius. So here is the radial density. This is an extremely narrow pore, 3 angstroms. So you can see if I'm really, really narrow, then I have excluded volume, and the helium just wants to line up right in the center. So this is not particularly exciting. It's basically a 1D system, and this is a snapshot of the density in the center. Now, as I change the radius of the pore, this is all fixed chemical potential, so I don't know a priori how many bosons, how many helium atoms are going to be inside these pores. I can get all kinds of features showing up. So for this particular case, this is 4 angstroms. Now I see no density in the center of the pore, and I see a single shell, right? And that's shown here in this density plot. This is the whole set of bosons all stuck into one slice of the pore. So I can keep increasing it. This is 10 angstroms. Now you see that there are these multiple shells, but there's also fuzziness in between them. So I have exchanges going back and forth between the pores. And actually, in this one, it's maybe difficult to see here, but if you look at the radial density plot, there's actually suppressed density. So there's not a lot of helium right in the center. And then at 12 angstroms, you actually see that you still get a bump in the center here. So this is 1, 2, 3 shells plus a nearly one-dimensional chain of helium right in the center. And you can keep doing this, and not surprisingly, eventually, these ripples get smaller and smaller, and then you just approach the bulk, right? So at some radius, the effects of the wall are going to be fully screened out, and you'll just get some flat density in the center, which is exactly what we find for suitably large pores. So this is the structure. This tells us what's going to happen inside the pore. And the existence of this finite density at the center is intriguing, because this really would be a quasi one-dimensional system. And so we'd like to we're simulating some high-energy microscopic theory of bosons, helium atoms in the continuum with all kinds of these detailed interactions. We want to know at long wavelengths, low energies, what's the effective behavior of these particles. So just a summary of that picture, basically what we find, and this is specific to the details of silicon nitride, is whenever the radius is approximately 3 times an integer number of angstroms, we find this finite density in the center. So this is just some empirical observation. When the radius is very small, less than 5 angstroms, we basically see no evidence of superfluidity, down to, actually now it's even lower, 0.2 Kelvin or something like that. So these are very stable shells that aren't very superfluid in the narrow pores. And the energy scales are huge here, so you can kind of understand that you don't, because of the very deep minimum, it doesn't make sense to have a lot of kinetic energy going on. You can always minimize your energy by just staying put right in the minimum of the wetting potential. For larger radius, about 10 angstroms, there is a finite superfluid fraction below 1 Kelvin. You see exchange, and you can actually, to see how much exchange, you can tag one of these bosons, make it indistinguishable, and watch it migrate between these shells in, as the simulation progresses, to make sure everything's reasonably ergodic. Okay, so in terms of the low energy effective theory, we thought, well, let's just focus on these pores that show finite density in the center, because this is probably the best place where we could hope to find a strictly one-dimensional system of helium. So let's focus on the ones that show this density in the core. And this system is pretty trivial, right? This is a clearly going to behave like a 1D chain of helium atoms. This one is much less trivial, but it still shows some finite density. So let's see if we can understand these two pores in terms of Luttinger liquid theory. Yep. So this is the quantum Monte Carlo. So basically, there's these trajectories, and these trajectories have some centroid, and so one can plot the density of those. Yeah. So this is a full quantum simulation of these helium atoms. All right. So. Yep. No. So the mean positions. So these plots right here are the positions of the zero slice beads, but from all beads in the whole, sorry, all helium atoms in the whole thing projected onto the z equals zero cut of the nanopore. Yeah, bead positions. Yeah, one can also look at, I mean, all of these estimators, centroid, average density, all these things. No, good expert question. Okay, so as I mentioned very early on, one of the reasons why I like working on low dimensional systems is because we can calculate all kinds of stuff, right? We have some quadratic Hamiltonian. So this is like a theorist's dream. I can actually evaluate the complete partition function. And then I can measure anything I want from that. The details of some, if in fact my system is behaving or can be described by this low energy Luttinger liquid description, then all of the details of the system, the mass, the details of the potentials, the chemical potential, are all plugged into these coefficients. V is the slope of the low energy density modes, the gapless mode, and K is this parameter that tunes me between the superfluid and the solid-like phase. So I'd like to be able to measure these from my given microscopic simulation. So as I said, all thermodynamic quantities can be calculated, and moreover, they can be calculated as functions of system size, temperature, this Luttinger velocity V, and Luttinger parameter K. So for example, this axial pair correlation function. So this is averaged over radius and angle. So it's only correlations. Again, I'm trying to see if the effective 1D behavior is described by this theory. So I can actually measure. I have real access to the density-density correlation function from the microscopic theory. I can compare it to the expression that one can find by calculating this axial density-density correlation function from Luttinger liquid theory. So this thing looks like a total mess. You can just brute force grind this expression out. It's written in terms of special functions, theta functions, and Dedekind eta functions. But the important thing here is basically there's some dimensionless scaling variable, V over L times T, that shows up here. And then everything else are things that are known, like the density at low temperatures, which we can just measure directly from the simulation. There's some unknown constant here, A, and this Luttinger liquid parameter, K. So the point of all of this is that if I can figure out what K and V are, these are emergent properties of the system that correspond to the zero temperature long wavelength theory, then this is a full finite temperature and finite size scaling function for the axial correlation function. So all I need to do is fit at one system size and one temperature. And if my system is acting like a Luttinger liquid, then this has to work everywhere else. So then I have a zero parameter fit. So this is an extremely constrained fitting procedure. You know, it's a zero parameter fit after I've done a single fit. And this thing looks like a mess, but in the thermodynamic limit, it's basically some density oscillations that are power law damped by this Luttinger parameter. And so as k gets really big, this thing goes away and I get strong oscillations. That's the solid. When k is really small, I get strong damping. This is the superfluid. Right? So this is the thermodynamic limit for it. Yep. It certainly does, and in this particular, so the reason why I chose the actual correlation function is these go like 1 over L, basically, but there's a coefficient in front of them that happens to be very small here. And so basically at the order of error bars in this simulation, you couldn't test these. And we've done lots of studies on systems where these irrelevant operator corrections could be important. They show up in things like the number distribution in strictly 1D systems, and we understand when they're important and when they're not. But that's a good question. This is just coming from the harmonic Luttinger theory. Okay, so first we can look at the extremely narrow pore, the one that had a radius of 3 angstroms, and we expect this one to be very well described by Luttinger liquid theory. Right, so it's already 1D. So here's some Monte Carlo time video of this pore at low temperatures. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to fit to this. So this is the raw data of this normalized pair correlation function. I know the density, right? I can just measure the number of particles instantaneously in my system. So I can scale by that. So that reduces the number of parameters that I have even further. This is the raw density. This looks very solid-like. These are different temperatures, 0.5 up to 1.25. So then I can fit to that Luttinger liquid prediction at a single temperature and a single system size. So I've done that here. So that's this gray line that works really well because I've done a fit. I can extract V and K. These are zero temperature properties. And then at all these other temperatures, there's no additional fitting that goes into it. So these are zero parameter fits basically at these higher temperatures. So this works incredibly well, but again, maybe not so shocking. I'm trying to describe an effectively 1D system with this effective 1D theory. So not particularly shocking there, just to show how well it works. And you can even determine when it breaks down. So this is a different plot This is a different plot now at fixed temperature. So I've fixed the temperature at 1 Kelvin. And now for this 3 angstrom pore, I plot the same thing, but at different system sizes, 50 angstrom, 75, up to 200. It's hard to see that in the yellow. And so here, the lines falling on top of these curves, again, are zero parameter fits. I've already extracted V and K once at one single fit. Then I just plot this function and see what it looks like. And so you can see that it doesn't work so well at small lengths. So this is when the finite size gap is becoming important in the system. So we'd expect that it breaks down. So one has a huge amount of confidence when you can tell, you know, this fit breaks down, this Luttinger liquid theory breaks down where we think it should, and it works very well at low temperatures, long wavelengths. So this is, again, maybe not particularly surprising because this really is a 1D system and inaccessible to experiments, really, this 3 angstrom pore. But let's do the same thing for the 12 angstrom pore. So this is just some snapshot. I've falsely colored these layers to get a picture of it. There's, again, 1, 2, 3 layers and then some finite density, so I can do the same thing. So the data here looks considerably more messy, again, because I have transverse modes that are coming into play. I'm not just a 1D system. But there's some reasonably interesting stuff that happens. So for example, you see that at high temperatures, you see something like here at this 1.75 Kelvin, you see some oscillations. At even higher temperature, they're gone. But then it looks like they even come back a little bit. Right? So there's all kinds of complicated structure in this plot related basically to the onset of superfluidity as we cool down. And again, we can do the same thing. We fit at one temperature. And I'm showing these on an expanded scale to show all of them. There is lots of structure in here that one can fit to. So one fits down here at 0.5 Kelvin, one system size, extracts Luttinger parameter, Luttinger velocity, and then does the zero parameter plot. And it works pretty darn well, right? So this is zero parameter fits, seems to pick all these up. It even gets the fact that there's more oscillations at some temperatures and less at other ones. So this seems to be working extremely well, right? That this all kind of comes together. So I would say that the summary of all of this is that the core here is certainly behaving like a Luttinger liquid. And we can describe the low energy, long wavelength properties of this the axial core of this pore in terms of Luttinger liquid theory. Yep. You can, and there's many different things that are ongoing right now. We're doing all kinds of stuff trying to understand different properties of these. You can certainly try to understand the length scales corresponding to transverse fluctuations and all kinds of stuff going on. Okay, so that's a great question. So these other shells, which are they're helical cylinders, if you like. And so one can certainly look at individual shells. So you can do that, for example, in the R=5 angstrom pore, where you just had a shell. So you can try to fit to those. At the temperatures that I was able to access in this, they're basically get very rapid decay of the pair correlation function. And so one can do fits, but I didn't have good enough confidence bars. Basically, my chi-squared, I had a lot of uncertainty. So there's probably more that can be done there, different estimators that we can measure to try to understand what's going on there. But there is some structure, some two-dimensional structure in those that's related to the details of the helium-helium interaction. And so there are some kind of transverse degrees of freedom. But the gapless mode might survive. So we're studying all of these issues right now.
So in terms of Lettinger liquid parameter, it should become less of a Lettinger liquid.
Yep.
So coming back to the picture there, if you look at, let's say the yellow one. So what's the aspect ratio, for example?
This one is 200 angstroms long and 20 angstroms in diameter, so 10 to 1.
So am I not approaching for the some kind of quasi-two-dimensional structure for the outer layers?
So these are definitely quasi-2D.
But then they would tend to...
Sure, but the point is that the largest oscillations in the pair correlation function are being picked up from this central region, and they're just dominating. So there's basically some low-energy mode corresponding to the 1D helium inside here. So you can think of it like these multi-channel Luttinger liquids. So let's say I have a ladder, right? You can write this down in terms of some effective new fields, and there's still some low energy gapless mode that survives, right? So the way to think, one way to think about these is like the multi-leg ladder.
What I'm thinking is, what's the state, so to speak, of the outer layer? Is it more?
Is it more liquid or? So these are all questions that we're trying to answer. So you can measure structure factors.
The response function is divergent, right, in the strictly 1D case. So it would have an infinite response to the conjugate potential from the outer layers, right? So whether or not it stays Lettinger-like or it's actually picking up a huge amount of response from the coating layers sounds complicated.
Well, so that's certainly true. So the next slide helps to answer this question in the sense that, so here's this phase diagram or this crossover phase diagram, if you like. So it's not just some completely arbitrary thing to measure these parameters, K, the Luttinger parameter. They tell us something about where these pores are on this phase diagram. And we know from various renormalization group arguments that the Luttinger liquid state is stable to certain types of perturbations based on the value of K. So in particular, if you have K less than a half, then the Luttinger liquid survives the perturbative breaking of translational symmetry. I can also say the disorder is irrelevant for some values of K. And so the idea would be these outer shells can, two things. One, the existence of the outer shells can screen inhomogeneities in the pore. That would be one thing. Screen disorder and all kinds of stuff. Screen the fact that the wall is actually corrugated, where I've approximated it as smooth. And so we're not quite there. So the value of K I find for this 12 angstrom pore is 1.3. So it's possible that these things would be relevant disorder. But hopefully the screening is enough. The screening of the layers is enough to make this phase persist. And so the one possibly positive piece of evidence for that is, so there's some people have spent a long time forcing helium inside porous glasses, where the pores would form, let's say, long 1D channels. Then you can do neutron scattering, you can do X-ray scattering on these things. And so in such a system, they see Bragg peaks that have some power law decay at very low temperatures, the width of these. And so you could correlate this with some algebraic order. So there's some papers on this. So this would be one experimental indication where they have networks of these pores, and maybe this is going on. Okay, so just to summarize, basically I had a lot of fun doing this work because I think that low D systems are Now, there are cases where you can really calculate things in strongly interacting cases. Path theorem of Monte Carlo is basically the only way to deal with the problem of strongly interacting bosons in the continuum. So there's no lattice. Right? This is, makes things complicated. I have a Galilean invariant system. The helium-4 inside these concentric shells seems to be well described by Luttinger liquid theory. So we do a fit at one temperature and one system size. And because of the special properties of the harmonic description for quantum fluids in 1D, we not only have the scaling form, we actually know the scaling functions for many observables. And so we don't have to search for data collapse because we actually can just plot the function and test. We can see where it works, where it doesn't work. And so because we can see both of those cases, we're pretty confident that the system can be described by Luttinger liquid theory. And as I said, we're just scratching the surface here. We think there's lots of stuff to be done. So thanks a lot.
For Adrian. You have kind of very sophisticated calculations, and then you have this very simple 1D model. I'm wondering if there's some intermediate level theory, like a mean field theory, gross PDFC or something, that could actually describe already quite some of the features of this system. Has anybody looked at that, or have you looked at
this? So when we originally saw these concentric shells, our minds went to this idea of this ladders, basically. So you have a 1D system that's connected to neighboring 1D systems, and so there's sort of effective mean field theory descriptions of these types of things. So we tried to do some angular momentum decomposition of this and build some things like this up exactly along the lines that you said, and we didn't find it particularly promising. It could be that there are such methods that could work very well, but because we could actually match the field theory with the real microscopic simulations and it worked pretty well, we were confident that this was, maybe some things, these are very complicated expressions and they fit very well, and they work at various temperatures and various system sizes. And so I'm not sure that sophistication could be captured in some kind of mean field models, but there may be some.
That axial density function, was it averaged over all shells and the core, or just the core itself? And have you looked at it for just the core?
So if you do it for the core, then you see much stronger oscillations. You see things that look more like the effective 1D system. Basically, there's no long range axial density order in the shells, and so that's all normalized to some that thing's been normalized, right? And so you don't see that's just some background. Basically.
So when you match the core, does that match closer to the Luttinger theory then?
Well, there's just, you have more, I mean, the values of V and K that you get are the same, basically. Yeah?
When you calculate the superfluid fraction, mm-hmm. you use the winding number?
Here, the winding number, yeah.
Can you look at the local contribution of each shell with the winding number?
We're definitely interested in doing that. That's an estimator that I have a student putting in my code right now. So a spatial map of the mm-hmm. permutation cycles. Or
that could answer the question about what is near the surface versus what is in the middle. Okay.
Other questions? That's great.
I have a question about the warm algorithm.
Yeah.
Suppose you increase the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Does the density of worms follow order parameter?
Well, so there's always, I did a terrible job of describing the worm algorithm. So one slide is not enough. So basically, there's only ever one worm in the simulation at a time. The worms are used basically to help explore the phase space in some sense. And they're unphysical. And so we only measure physical estimators when they're not present. Right, so the simulation is constantly moving between the diagonal ensemble where there are no worms and the off-diagonal one where there's a single worm. And you only do measurements of physical observables like energy or superfluid density when there are no worms. So that means that the worm has either shrunk to a point and been taken out, or it's grown, the head and the tail have met, and I've added an extra particle to the simulation. And so you can use this to study everything up to reasonably high temperatures, and you can calculate the full equation of state, and everything is exactly what you'd expect for a high temperature Bose gas.
For example, about TC, about the superfluid state, worms may not be necessary.
So they may not be necessary, but if you're grand canonical, this is the only way to be grand canonical, basically.
Other questions? So if nothing else, Adrian's available for further discussion, I think in the bistro for about half an hour during free beer time. So I encourage you all to join us. Let's thank him again for a wonderful conversation.